Okay. So fear is a very important part of both the spiritual life and also just any old life of being alive, I believe. And as we do a mindfulness practice or an awareness practice, one of the important emotions or feelings, responses that we become sensitive to, aware of, become familiar to it, is fear. And we become familiar with fear both in the sense of getting to know it, but also familiar in the sense of becoming comfortable with it, becoming at ease with it, so that we're not frightened by our fear, or not aversive to our fear, or not confused by the fact that we're afraid. It's possible that fear is one of the most common emotions that we have that causes us difficulty or trouble or inhibits us in our lives. A lot of people, as soon as they start doing some kind of self-reflective practice, getting aware of what goes on inside of themselves, their thoughts and their feelings, become surprised to the degree in which fear is a big part of their life. It's fairly common for people to come to me and say, I didn't know that there's an underlying pervasive layer of fear that's there all the time. You know, I didn't know it was there all the time. It's always pretty subtle. It's kind of like it's like the background or the wallpaper. And it's always there, the fear. And you know, the fear can be many things, and we all have our own pet fears that are kind of the loudest or the most strongest influence in our lives. But there's the fear of rejection, a fear of what other people are going to think of us, fear of making a fool of ourselves, the fear of losing our security, the fear of what are some of your fears that you guys have? Can you add to the list?
Fear of losing people that I love.
Fear of losing people that you love.
Mm-hmm. Fear of death.
Fear of death.
Fear of not being able to take care of yourself.
Uh-huh.
Fear of wasting your life.
Fear of wasting your life.
Fear of fear.
Fear of fear. Keep the fear at arm's distance. What else?
Fear of not achieving what we want.
But I wonder... if that's a little bit abstract way of saying you're afraid of something else. What are you afraid will happen to you if you don't achieve, if you don't achieve what you want to achieve?
Uh-huh.
You might ask, you kind of explore a little bit. What are you afraid? Why is it so bad not to achieve what you want? What would happen to you that would cause you fear or cause you...
Think about it.
Sorry?
Typically, you're afraid to choose your face at this point, right?
Choose your...
That you lose your face.
Lose your face.
Because you assume that you would achieve something and you fail?
So a fear of embarrassment is connected to that. What else?
Fear of change.
Fear of change. Does that cover them all? That's a big one, fear of change. And the perception, the insight of change is one of the important insights that comes with mindfulness practice. And so to the degree in which we're afraid of change, to that degree, to the degree in which we're afraid of change, to that degree, as the practice deepens, the practice itself will evoke fear, because the practice reveals how things are changeable, how they change. What else? Fear of speaking in front of a group? The rest of you? Fear of the unknown.
What do you mean the practice reveals how things change?
Not how so much, but that they do.
That they do.
Yeah. The practice If you pay very careful attention to what's going on in your experience, you'll find that your experience is changing very rapidly. And the things that we kind of want to rely on and we want for our security, to provide us with security, aren't there as steadily and as fixedly as we might hope. And this is true in small, microscopic details of experience. And it's obviously true in great things. You know, for example, we put our security in our loved ones disappear. So what happens then if we don't have them to provide us with security?
Fear of anger.
Fear of our own power. Sometimes it's connected, the two are connected, but sometimes not.
Fear of success.
Again, for all these things you can ask this kind of second level of question, but what are you afraid will happen if you succeed?
Amorphous. I've seen myself undo myself, and that's kind of what I assumed what it was. It's hard to nail down.
Afraid you undo yourself.
I've seen myself undo myself from do things to sabotage myself, to stop myself from getting what I thought I wanted.
So afraid of success, so then you undermine the success, or undermine the possibility of it.
Sure.
But what's motivating the undermining? What are you afraid will happen if you succeed?
Maybe change. At the same time, wanting it.
Those second level questions are tough.
Are tough? They're second level questions in a sense, but I propose to you that they get closer to what's primarily going on. That sometimes what we state what we're afraid of, that's the second level actually of, removed actually from what we're really afraid of. And so as an exercise, you might ask yourself sometimes, what am I afraid of? Oh, I'm afraid of A happening. If A happens, then what am I afraid will happen if A happens? So, for example, I'm afraid of failure. Well, really what you might be afraid of is you might be afraid of the embarrassment of losing face. And it might be more interesting to study or become aware of how we're concerned about our reputation or our face or whatever than it is about failure itself. Does that make sense? It's interesting that Buddhism has five great fears that they lists. And I don't remember all five, I think, at the moment, but one is fear of death. The other is fear of unusual states of mind. And the third is fear of losing one's livelihood. The fourth is probably fear of losing those who are close to us or dear to us. And the fifth is fear of public speaking. What?
Sort of seems to be sort of incompatible in way.
It seems that way, but I think there are people, I know people who probably would prefer to die than to speak in front of a crowd of people. And maybe they're incompatible, but fear of death and fear of speaking in front of others, fear of speaking in front of others, what is that? It's probably a complicated thing, but perhaps in a kind of metaphorical way, maybe ultimately it's a kind of fear of dying, a fear of our self-identity or self-image dying in front of others. Because many of us, our self-identity, our self-image is so important. Fear of rejection, which is kind of a dying also, maybe. Unusual states of mind. Sorry?
It sounds like drugs. What does that mean?
It could be drugs, but there are a lot of unusual states of mind that can happen. It takes one form. It takes is afraid of going crazy. I've known a lot of people for whom they had a parent who actually went a little bit. I don't know what the right word is, but a little bit crazy. They were maybe institutionalized in a mental hospital or something. And growing up then with that idea that they're happened to their parent, they're afraid that the same thing will happen to them, those states of mind, so they're afraid of that. But there can be powerful states of mind, kind of openings of consciousness, unusual states of consciousness, unusual states of perception, black holes that we fall into of severe depression or severe anxiety, or all kinds of strong states of mind that might arise that we're afraid of. Fear of intimacy, not the same thing exactly, but I'm just came to my mind right now. No one said it. Fear of, yes.
Someone said that people who do a lot of planning in their meditation have fear. So is that really true?
I don't like so much the language "true" because then there seems to be. I wouldn't say it's always the case.
So I'm trying to figure out. This is like the only time I have quiet in my life, so I can plan.
Maybe.
Or if there's actual fear involved, because I spent a lot of time reflecting on that, because you brought it up.
Yeah.
And I can't figure out what I'm afraid of.
It might
maybe forgetting to do something.
Maybe. I think the investigation shouldn't be, in this case, maybe, you know, what you're afraid of, but more not thinking of analyzing it so much, but just drop into your body and feel what's going on in your body. And it might be a very, very low level of apprehension or subtle anxiety. So you feel your way into it rather than kind of think what it might be or what it's about. But it might not be fear. But more often than not, people spend a lot of time in planning. There's a kind of a level of apprehension that seems to be the factory for it. But I wouldn't say always. I mean, planning, to some degree of planning, is necessary, inherent part of life. And if you never do any planning the rest of your life, if you're completely not given any chance, and you know, at all, you might have to have finally you get the outlet for kind of healthy amount of planning. I don't know. So I wouldn't pathologize or problematize everything, But if you do the investigation, do the sensing into your body, and you don't find any fear, then I wouldn't worry about it.
I'm not worried about it. I thought I'd bring it up.
But usually, if something is very reoccurring, it seems like you try to go back to be in the present moment, you try to be with your breath a little bit, and the common thing you keep going back to over and over is the same thing, then there's something which is fueling it. And it might not be fear. It could also be, for example, excitement or curiosity. It could be delight even. You know, you have mindless delights in ordering, bringing everything into order. You're putting order into everything, and it just brings you a tremendous sense of, you know, of security and well-being to know that everything can be kind of, at least in your imagination, tomorrow it could be this way.
What?
Sorry?
I mean, isn't that then a hindrance to meditating? Because then you're like going down.
I wouldn't say it's a hindrance to meditation, but to be preoccupied in that is a hindrance to being present. Because when we're preoccupied, the definition of preoccupation, in a sense, is not being present because you're lost in some concern. And what we're trying to do in meditation is not to be preoccupied in anything. But that doesn't mean we're trying to stop everything. It's just simply not preoccupied. But who's in control? You or the planning?
That's a good question. It depends.
If the planning's in control,
you're
probably not free. And if
I can go away from it, back to the breath, but then I'll be very concentrated for a moment, and then I might go back to that, or I might plan something else. Yeah. And sometimes I don't plan anything for days at a time.
I see. So I don't know. Just
I'm trying to figure out what it means.
That's your job.
Is the fear part of the Western consciousness, and is it different for people from Asia?
It's possible that the details might be different, but fear is pretty universal. And so the Buddha listed the five great fears, right? So maybe for us, maybe those five are only true for Indian, you know, ancient Indians from 2,500 years ago, maybe. But I suspect that sounds pretty. You know, maybe we could come up with a sixth one, you know, for our culture. But fear itself, I think, is a pretty universal phenomena.
Perhaps the type of fear I'm talking about is the low-level anxiety.
It's possible that anxiousness, for example. The fear of perhaps, you know, the fear of what people will think of us, the fear of rejection, perhaps isn't as strong in a community that's tightly bound, strong family connections, strong village or town connections. You know everybody, and you grew up with all these siblings who took care of you, and a lot of people who loved you. And it's possible that in that kind of environment, and that could happen in this country also in some small communities, that the kind of sense of unworthiness, a sense of being alienated, and the kind of feelings that might arise from that, the loneliness, the anxiety of being rejected, might not be so prevalent. So I think the details of what we're afraid of could be very different in different cultures and different backgrounds. But fear, I think, is pretty universal. It's universal enough so that the Buddha defined the fulfillment of the Buddhist path as attaining a state of fearlessness. And it's considered one of the great gifts you can give others is the gift of fearlessness, your fearlessness. But the details could be particular, you know, to differences, different cultures. Do you have any experience in comparative studies?
A little bit, yeah.
And what do you know?
Well, it was when I redefined it as anxiety that the link to Western culture and Western consciousness became much more clear. And what you were talking about, the sense of alienation, fragmentation, that's more associated with Western culture.
There's some famous stories that I've told a few of them, told them here. But one of them is Ajahn Sumedho, who was a American monk who lived in Thailand for many years, now teaches in England. And he was asked once, what was the difference between being a teacher for Thais and being a teacher for Westerners? Well, you know, and he said, self-hate. In the West, there's a lot of self-hate. And he didn't encounter the degree of kind of epidemic self-hate among people in Thailand. So there are differences. And self-hate, feelings of unworthiness, feeling of shame, are very strong, seemingly epidemic in our culture here.
But there are also strong cultural differences, and also the differences in the way people live here and there. So even if you are fearless, your choice is being lonely, because you cannot just live among the people who don't share your point of view this way.
So, if I understand you, or just to kind of continue that train of thought, one of the common fears for people who practice is that inner changes that are happening as they practice will make them kind of lose their connection with their friends or their family or society around them. And some of that is kind of a necessary fear, because to some degree it's not going to happen, but to some degree there is a kind of change like that. And especially sometimes kind of, you know, the integration of the sense of integrity that can arise through meditation practice, the integration of that integrity, of that sense of fulfillment into our daily actions and our daily conversations and relationships is a whole practice in itself. It's a whole difficult task to learn. And a lot of people will find that they get afraid of their own spiritual practice, because it's requiring them to explore a new way of being with their friends and family that's different than who they were before, and then the relationships might have to change. So my own example was that when I started sitting on a regular basis, I was living with a couple of friends, and I felt at some point that I either had to give up my friends or give up my meditation practice, because who I was becoming through my meditation practice was different than how I was usually with my friends. No one of us could figure out, you know, how to find a new relationship. So in that case, I actually gave up my meditation practice because I didn't know how to integrate it. It took me some time before I was able to start again. And some of our, you know, so for example, some of our friends, some of our professions, some of our relationships are based sometimes on a lot of, on particular patterns of personality, particular patterns of relating to each other. So for example, some people we might know, the way we relate to them is that we boost each other's ego by criticizing all the people we know. You know, you get together and you gossip. You know what the person did? My boss today is such a jerk, and this person's so terrible, and everybody else is so bad but us, right? And that's, you know, and so we kind of play this game, and each time you play it, you feel kind of, you know, you get energy from being critical, and you kind of feel kind of bonding with the other person. You feel really great, and you feel like you belong with this person and really close. But, you know, it's at the expense of feeling separate. And as you sit in your spiritual practice or in your self-awareness practice and realize, wait a minute, this feels kind of yucky to always be kind of criticizing everyone, you know. I don't know if I want to continue always criticizing people, so I'll try not doing it. And then you meet your friend, and your friend still wants to play the game, but you don't want to play the game. And then you want, well, what kind of friendship do we have if we don't have, if the friendship has been established on this game of criticism? What kind of friendship do I have if I'm not playing the game? And it can be very frightening. Oh my God, I might lose my friend because we don't have any basis except through criticism. And so it can be frightening. And some people might decide that, you know, to kind of, in a sense, let go of those friends. And some people might decide or find that they can find new ways of being with those friends based on a different premise, based on a different way of relating. So the practice itself can bring fear on many different levels. Fear of what's arising within us, fear of what we have to see about ourselves. Self-knowledge is seldom nice. It's often kind of a surprise what we learn about ourselves, we pay attention. And many of us also, but we can be afraid of, you know, how our relationships might change as a result. And I hope you have some sense that you're not becoming asocial through a spiritual meditation practice. Isn't that you're supposed to become separate and removed and distant? And meditation practice, I hope, doesn't do that for you. But it might mean a re-evaluation and a reorientation of some of the values by which you've organized your life. And sometimes that requires real change. And to expect that a spiritual practice will never require you to change, kind of sacrifice something, is actually unrealistic. It does require, you know, maybe sacrifice or renunciation at times. For example, the story I like to tell is of a lawyer who came to retreat, and he came for interview with a teacher, and he said, I'm a lawyer, and in my particular law practice, the kind of clients I have, the kind of situation I find myself in, I'm expected to lie. Can you please tell me how I can be a good Buddhist practitioner and lie at the same time? And he expected an answer. He expected some positive, you know, little trick of the trade to do that. And we had to tell him, sorry, you know, there's no way you can do this. And you know, if you're really serious about, you know, developing your self-awareness, developing your sense of personal integrity, at some point you have to renounce your lying. And perhaps that means finding a different kind of law practice or a different kind of occupation. So sometimes spiritual practice does require something of us, and that creates fear also.
Or finding different friends, but it may not be easy.
It may not be easy. So sometimes there's a transition period in people's lives. The transition period is quite awkward because, you know, we don't have the support, don't have the kind of contact and friendship that we used to have. But for some people, they have fine relationships with others, and they find that a meditation practice or a mindfulness practice doesn't require them to give up their friendships or their relationships. It just makes them richer and make them feel closer because there's less fear, less inhibition, less being preoccupied. And when you're less preoccupied, you're more attentive for other people. And if you're more attentive for other people, the relationships become richer. So fear. The simplest definition of fear, perhaps, is that it's a movement of aversion to pain, aversion to feeling pain of some sort or other. And I don't know if some of you are studying psychology. Do you have a better definition of fear? Linda, do you know? I just dreamt that up as a definition.
No, but it's really defined. It's usually only defined against anxiety. And fear is usually that which has an object, and anxiety is the sort of fear without an object, the free-floating kind of
thing. So, in Buddhist psychology, fear is connected to aversion. It's a form of aversion. But I think aversion to pulling back from, in a sense, from some kind of threat. Maybe not necessarily just pain, but just some kind of threat. And what's interesting about in Buddhist psychology is that categorizes or divides fear into some kinds of fears which are considered healthy to have, and some which are considered unhealthy to have. Some which are appropriate to have is a range of kind of experiences we go through life, and some which are not. And so it isn't that all our fears are problematic. Some fears are actually, the Buddhist word is our guardians. My wife listened to NPR the other day, and they were interviewing someone who wrote a book called The Gift of Fear. Somebody heard the program? Is that the name of the book? This person thought something of fear is a real gift because, as she explained it to me, there's a lot of real creative responses that can happen under the intensity of fear. And sometimes that's true. One of the forms of fear which in Buddhist psychology is considered healthy is the fear of violating, in a sense, our personal integrity. You know, we get a sense from our meditation practice of a sense of integrity, a sense of wholeness, a sense of personal honesty. Or integrity is the word I like use the most. And there'd be a fear of doing something that threatens that, or destroys that, or violates that. So, lying, for example, if you're very sensitive, you'll notice how lying will actually taint or color or darken over or fragment the sense of integrity within you. Hurting someone else intentionally, hurting someone, stealing from someone, you can't really do those things without the kind of violation of your integrity. And to feel afraid of that, to feel it coming, feel looming up, the possibility. And then there's a kind of a pulling back, kind of a fear, which is not not considered a problem in Buddhism. If you don't have that kind of fear, you're considered to be unhealthy in Buddhism. So fear is not such a bad, the kind of fear which is Buddhism calls unwholesome or unhealthy. Is often the kind of fear which is maybe kind of non-specific. It has to do with anxiety. It has to do with threats which are not really clear and present. You know, if someone is about to mug you, it's good to be afraid. And I think that was kind of the example my wife used in telling me about this NPR book review. The gift of fear. The guy said something like, "If you're about to be mugged, it's good to be afraid, and because the fear might, elicit unusual, appropriate responses that you can take care of yourself." And I suspect that's probably true oftentimes, but many of us, our fear is often mixed with anxiety. So we're about to get mugged, and not only are we afraid, but we're also very anxious. And so, can we be afraid without being anxious? What would that look like? Because I've had a lot of friends who've been held up because where I lived in the Zen Center in San Francisco, it was a A high mug area. And many times I've heard Zen students say, you know, I was held up. It was, what was really remarkable was how calm I was. And they attribute it to their meditation practice. And I just seemed to know what to do that kind of kept the situation under control. I didn't freak out. I didn't make things worse. I kind of was able to deal with it. There was one friend of mine who was held up at knife point. And he took out his wallet and said, look, this is what I have. And you're welcome to it, except, you know, I need a little bit of money to get home. Can't you? I need to keep a little bit of it. But I'll give you the rest. And they had this conversation back and forth talking about... And another friend walked by them and thought they were just having a conversation and just kept going. and he kind of meant it. He didn't mind too much giving him the money, and he wanted some money for himself, and so they kind of worked it out. Sorry?
Isn't it actually healthy?
Fear?
Yeah, I mean, this sense, for example, you learn from your previous events in your life, right?
Yes.
Then you may avoid it if you're afraid.
But yeah, learning from our experiences is a wise thing to do. But sometimes we make the wrong conclusions from our experience. So, for example, if we get... it sounds like Linda was, you know, she had kind of, maybe she was afraid, but she didn't listen to it well enough, and so she allowed herself to get into a situation where she was mugged. And so then as a result of that, she doesn't trust herself anymore. It doesn't trust her own ability to kind of really notice realistically what the difference is between a threatening situation and not. And so then she has this heightened, unnecessary heightened level of fear all the time, because she's learned she can't trust herself anymore. And that kind of reactive level of heightened fear might or might not be useful. One of the interesting things about Buddhist practice, I believe, or Buddhism, is that it actually takes all these things, all our fears, all our even anger, and all kinds of what are considered to be kind of negative emotions here in the West, and say they all are, in a sense, things to be respected, because they all indicate that something needs to be paid attention to. So in a sense, in a kind of funny way, we can say all fear is healthy, because it says there's something here which is wrong, and so I need to find out what that is. And if someone's about to mug you, you might find out you're about to be mugged, and you better get some help. But if you find yourself feeling anxious all the time, then that constant anxiety is also an indication something needs to be paid attention to. And so what is that? What is it that really needs attending to? Maybe it's the fact that you've learned you can't trust yourself because you don't know how to pay attention to your emotions and feelings. And if that's the case, well, maybe you need to learn the skills to have greater self-awareness. Yes?
That really fits back in with the point I was asking about cultures before, because if as a society we we reinforce this low this free-floating anxiety, and so that among our friends or groups or organizations or institutions, the patterns of behavior reinforce that, then it takes a tremendous amount of effort for individuals to recondition their experience to be counter what is the reinforcing patterns.
I think so. So give one example.
Try not to be a loser in the US.
Try not to be a loser. Yes.
I was surprised before, and kind of after what you said made for the reason when you said the Buddha said one of the greatest gifts is to give somebody, you know, to not be fearful anymore. And I, as you went on to say, I thought though too, fear can be a very useful thing. Is that, did you really mean unhealthy fear there? Or?
Fearlessness in terms of, you know, as a kind of goal in Buddhism is not the absence of fear necessarily, but rather is you're not controlled by your fear. You're not preoccupied, you're not caught by your fear. So fear might be there, but you see it as something that's there. You recognize it, but you don't, and then you respond to it wisely. Say, oh, this is information I need to find out. Is this really a real threat now, or is it just an imagined threat? And you know, so but the gift of fearlessness is, I think, what it's more is that to be around someone who seems to be fearless feels very reassuring. And so the gift of fear—you're not giving people, you know, making them fearless necessarily, but you're providing them with your sense of you are fearless. You know, not in the sense of the decal some people have behind their four-wheel drive pickup trucks that says, what does it say? Have no fear. I think that's a little bit different meaning in Buddhist fearless.
What is the, you know, there's an alternate amount of movies that absolutely instill fear, you know, I mean, that's exactly what they're for, you know, the horror movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost, it seems like a cult, you know, I mean, why would people want to do that? I mean, fear is so, I mean, it's hurtful, you know, if you have it for a long time. Why would generally younger people want to do that?
I'll give two theories, and then maybe some of you guys can offer some ideas. One is, recently, a friend overheard this conversation between her 2.5-year-old and a 4-year-old. They were talking with each other. And the 4-year-old had just gone to see some kind of movie. I don't know what it was. And she was talking about how it was really frightening. She was really afraid. And the 2.5-year-old said, oh, I won't go. I'm not going to go see that. You know, I don't want to see that. Why did you go see it? And the 4-year-old said, oh, it was really neat. And I, you know, maybe there's a certain level, maybe, you know, developmentally, that kind of exploration of emotion, emotional states, and there's kind of a, maybe for this 4-year-old, it was kind of exciting to be in an environment where there was fear, but also at the same time knowing was safe, and kind of exploring limits and exploring things. So maybe it's, you know, sometimes developmentally, it's kind of an interesting thing to do. Another reason, perhaps theory, would be some people live a very unfulfilled lives and are really kind of maybe sometimes cut off from themselves emotionally and don't have a lot of natural sense of aliveness within them. And going to a terror movie can really get the aliveness pumping really fast, up and alive. And some, it's kind of a rush you get from that. And you feel really alive and really energized and really, you know, you're not preoccupied with your loneliness or your, you know, your relationships with others or with, you know, all these kinds of concerns you might have. And you feel really great. So it can be kind of an addiction to get this kind of rush of adrenaline or whatever that might come and makes you feel more alive. So those are two theories.
I just want to add, a fear of unusual body, bodily space is another.
Yes.
It's kind of healthy, but it's also anxiety producing and stress producing. So it's really a trap.
Yes.
Wouldn't it, if you're going to a horror movie, wouldn't that be, like, couldn't it release sometimes things that you've trapped inside maybe?
Maybe so, yeah.
That would be the reason why someone would go.
Maybe so, yeah.
You know how you're always telling us to pay attention to the feelings that we have in our body when we're meditating? Well, I was thinking about that in relation to this talk that you're giving us about fear, and saying that fear is an aversion to feeling pain. So I noticed when we did that body scan one time, I noticed how upset I was when we did that. And I think that the reason that I was upset about it is because I was having that aversion to feeling pain. It was like you kept making me pay attention to my body. And I was getting more and more angry with you because there was something I didn't want to pay attention to.
In your body?
Yeah. But I didn't know that that was what was going on, and I didn't know. I didn't know that for a long time. But that's clearly what was going on. And so I was just thinking, the thing that you said about self-knowledge is seldom pleasant. So this whole meditation thing is really quite a process, isn't it?
That's for sure.
I mean, I feel like I've embarked on this you know, this river trip, and now I'm on it, and you know, it's like I'm never quite sure what's going to be around the next bend, but it's like I'm allowing it all to happen. But it is quite an adventure, isn't it?
It's quite an adventure. And you know, in a sense, perhaps the opposite of fear is trust. And one of the things we can learn by doing a practice like this is a kind of a trust. So as you go down the river, you know, of life, you can trust, kind of you can float on top of it, rather than having to constantly kind of swim against the current or trash around and drown or whatever we do. In a sense, the opposite of being living a life that's full of fear is living a life that's trustful.
But you may be fearless and still not be trustful.
Sorry?
I believe you may not be fearless. I believe you may be fearless but still not be trustful.
I guess it's possible.
Something
added. There's maybe two kinds of trust. One is you trust something, which is kind of a thing you do. You add that to your life. And the other is a kind of trust which is not really a thing at all. Doesn't really even exist. It's simply the absence of fear.
Yeah.
And I call that trust. But as soon as you give it a name, it's kind of like it becomes a thing. But it's really the absence of anxiety and
of course it's trusting yourself versus trusting others, which is something else.
I think that enlightenment is having trust that has no object. It's not even trusting yourself. You know, it's just trust. can you let go of fear enough? Can you let go enough? So it's enough just to trust without even knowing what you're trusting. It doesn't have to be an object to the trust. That's one of the things we learn in this practice, that awareness is a wonderful thing to trust.
Remember there was I don't remember the whole poem, but in one of the insights were shared, something about practice the way it will always sustain you. And that seemed to me, when you talk about trust, I get kind of disturbed. So I don't really know how I trust in what.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's... That's pretty good. I think that's very good. It's one of the things we learned, that we can trust, maybe this way, we can trust our life when we are aware of it. But maybe we can't trust our life. Maybe we can't trust our life so much when there's not the awareness there. What's going on? Yes.
There's a little haiku that says, "Simply trust. Don't the leaves flutter down just like that."
Nice.
Is blind trust, I think, like that could get you in trouble.
Oh, yes. Usually the word is blind faith. And that's, again, you know, that's believing. Usually that's kind of believing something without having any proof or verification that it's the case. And a trust is a, you know, there's a kind of a spectrum, a range between belief and faith and trust and confidence, perhaps. And trust is not so much, you know, a belief system, but it's more like it's a kind of confidence. And you can't, I don't know, I guess you can have blind confidence, you know. No fear. Let's go.
Friend of rock climb said all of her friends who have no, have had no fear are no longer with us.
So fear has definitely has its place. You know, I had a whole talk to give about fear, and, you know, we just scratched the surface. Should we continue next week?
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is like, fear is so important.
Seems like a big subject.
Spend the next, if we just understand this one, we don't have to understand anything more about Buddhism. And that's why the Buddhist notion of fearlessness, it doesn't mean the absence of fear, but it means that you're not controlled by your fear. But certainly if it's there, you pay attention. And maybe one of the things I'll talk about next week more is in a sense, all fear is healthy. In a sense. And next week maybe I'll talk about how that's the case. Yes?
Would that mean you're saying about trust and trust not wanting to have an object of trust? That mean you want to then objectify fear, like make it an object?
Yeah, I don't follow.
Well, you said like, trust is something that really gets rid of fear, or is a way to get not to be affected by it, controlled by it, and you don't want an object. But I don't remember the exact words you used. It was you want a you want a non-objectified
trust.
And so then when you want to objectify fear, then do the opposite of it.
I think what you want to do with fear is to understand it really well. Mm-hmm. And the more you understand fear, the less power it has over you. And so it isn't so much a matter of getting rid of the fear, but coming to a kind of a sense, coming to a place where the fear is not controlling us, but rather, you know, we're in charge. But you know, this is, you know, we don't. This is just a generalized way of talking, you know. But in a general sense, we're trying to understand fear, so it doesn't control us.
I think something you've said a number of times is pretty relevant, which is if you recognize fear, you know the source of the fear, then you have a choice about what you do about fear,
right,
as opposed to just being overwhelmed by it.
Right, exactly.
And I think that kind of makes the distinction between whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, because you can, if you know it's there, I mean, I know some of my fears, which are clear to me now, that weren't a year ago, and now I make choices about those that I couldn't do a year ago.
Right. And one of the choices we can make is to try to understand better the roots of it. If you see fear as a response, what is it a response to? What is it a response? What's really, where is it arising out of? And in that sense, what are you trying to protect? Is one way of asking a question. And so one of the choices when fear arises to kind of look deeper. See what else is, what's the roots of this fear, and get to know it better. And
you don't think it's possible to make friends with it? I mean, at the real stretch of my imagination, I think maybe it's possible to have a sort of mutual respect with it.
Absolutely.
Like, no, I can't entertain that possibility. Respect.
I like it. Yes, it's possible.
I notice when I, public speaking, I get fearful, and with fear comes adrenaline. And, you know, I know if I don't have that, you know, flap. And so I actually do look forward to the fear, because I know it makes me more energetic. It also makes me prepare harder. So And that's the case, that once I recognize it, I actually do look forward to the slight amount of fear.
Organizational question. Obviously, everybody is interested in the relevant questions, and we don't move too far with your talk. Would it make sense to hold the questions and let you address all the issues that you want to address so we can learn and then have questions? Because on the topic like that, it's a lot of discussion, and a lot of everybody has ideas and problems or whatever.
It's a good observation. Sometimes that's true, it works better that way. And sometimes it works better to kind of let the collective wisdom, the collective questions and collective kind of movement and process and development take its own way. And it also depends what we're trying to do here. If you're simply just trying to impart my particular limited understanding and knowledge, you better shut up, right? But what we're trying to do is also, for example, other things. For example, sometimes just get to know each other better and get to know that we're not so different. Many of us have some of the similar issues and how different people deal with different things and what their concerns are. Having more of a group sharing is actually more important. And so it varies. And so that kind of concern, what you bring up, is in the back of my mind. So next week when I come, I have to consider, you know, what should I do? What's best now? This week, should I just spend the next 20 minutes just doing a talk, since we've had so much kind of discussion already? Or should we just continue more the discussion? And I thought today was great. I really appreciated very much all your participation and sharing. And I hope that you all found it valuable to do it this way. Also, the other reason to ask, to be more open and have questions, is that I know that my responses are maybe more relevant, more closely relevant to what your concerns are. If I just sit up here and talk, you know, give a monologue, how do I know that it has any relevance to anyone, right? That's the risk of giving talks. You know, you're just kind of in my own little world talking away here. And
are you afraid of that? Are you afraid of that?
I'm not afraid of it, but I'm concerned about what is most useful for us here together. What serves us the best. And one of the things I like about Thursday is Thursdays does give us a chance to have more discussion and talk more. And if you want to get my monologues, you should come on Monday. we'll talk about fear next week. And one of the things, since we're going to pick up the theme again, one of the things that would be nice for all of you is if you would study your fear during the next week, during the week. Just become a kind of connoisseur. Just you notice the fears that arise and pass. Notice the fears, the subtle fears. Maybe it's more interesting to study the most subtle fears during the next week than it is the powerful ones, the big ones. But whatever way, just... you know, spend a week getting to be really familiar with the movements of fear in your life, and then we'll have more material to talk about. So let's end with a very, very short sitting, a mini sit.